good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp.
You're listening to episode 533 of Unwelcome Guests, the False Flag Formula. I'm Robin Upton. Regular listeners will be all too familiar with the events and cover-up surrounding 9/11. We will not be looking at 9/11 this week because I thought I would put that in the context of the false flag strategy, sadly employed all too commonly by national governments. So this week we'll be looking at the apartment bombings in Russia, we'll be looking at the insurgency in Iraq, some slightly more light-hearted material on the underwear bomber, some thoughts about the 7/7 London bombings, and we'll be hearing from Annie Machon, an MI5 insider, on the role that British intelligence had assassinating civilians in Libya, and some thoughts on the bombing of the Israeli embassy in London. But to start us off, I'd like to play a 7-minute clip about the role of the false flag. This is called When False Flags Don't Fly by James Corbett from 2010.
Those who have studied history know that nothing invigorates and empowers an authoritarian regime more than a spectacular act of violence, some sudden and senseless loss of life that allows the autocrat to stand on the smoking rubble and identify himself as the hero. It's at moments like this that the public, still in shock from the horror of the tragedy that has just unfolded before them, can be led into the most ruthless despotism. Despotism that now bears the mantle of security. Acts of terror and violence never benefit the average man or woman. They only ever benefit those in positions of power. This is why Nero fiddled while Rome burned. It gave him a chance to throw out the Christians to the lions and rebuild the capital of the Roman Empire in his own image. This is why Hearst and the warmongers of the emerging American Empire were delighted by the destruction of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor in 1898. It gave them the excuse they needed to rouse the public into supporting the Spanish-American War. This is why Israel attacked the USS Liberty in 1967 during the Six-Day War, strafing and torpedoing it relentlessly for hours in a vain attempt to send it to the bottom. The Israelis believed that the loss of the Liberty could be blamed on Egypt and draw the Americans into war. This is why there are hundreds of documented examples of government staging attacks in order to blame them on their political enemies. In every civilization, in every culture, in every historical period, authoritarians have known that spectacular acts of violence help to further consolidate their own power and control. And sadly, throughout history, there have been all too many willing to allow attacks to occur, to pretend that attacks have occurred, or even to attack their own population in order to further their political agenda. To think that such staged provocations and false flag attacks no longer occur would be as unrealistic as believing that human nature itself has changed, that powerful people no longer seek to increase their power, that influence is never used for deceit or manipulation, that lies are no longer told to satisfy greed or slake the thirst for control. It is to believe that our society is immune from those things that we have seen in every other society, in every other era. In short, it's a dangerous delusion. The people are once again learning the power of this delusion. They are learning the extent to which they have been lied to. They are once again studying their history. The Russians are learning how the FSB was caught planting bombs in Moscow in 1999 during a terror scare that swept Putin into power and stirred the public into supporting the Second Chechen War. They are learning how their autocratic ex-president came to power campaigning on the graves of those his old FSB cronies had killed. The Israelis are learning how Mossad has been caught time and again posing as the very Muslim terrorists they claim to be opposing. They're learning how Israel uses the specter of terror to further extend their blank check drawn on American funds to expand their police state at home and maintain their hardline stance, the world's sixth largest nuclear superpower supposedly threatened by the possibility that one of their neighbors may one day obtain a single nuclear weapon. The British are learning how their SAS officers were caught dressing up as Arabs in Iraq, driving around with trucks full of munitions, shooting at police to stir up ethnic tensions and ensure that permanent bases could be built in the region. They are learning how Harun Aswat, the supposed mastermind behind the 7/7 bombings, was working for British intelligence. They are learning how British military intelligence took part in IRA bombings. The Indians are learning how the Mumbai attack was helped by a U.S. agent who is cooperating with investigators so that he won't face questioning by foreign authorities. The Canadians are learning how their own provincial police dressed up as protesters in 2007 and threatened violence against other police in order to force a crackdown on peaceful protests. And the Americans. The Americans are learning that there were multiple bombs found, dismantled, and taken out of the Alfred P. Murrah building on April 19, 1995. They are learning that Timothy McVeigh had written a letter to his sister in which he claimed to be in the special forces for the U.S. Army. They are learning the bombing was being directed by FBI informants, just as the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was. They are learning about 9/11 and the Gulf of Tonkin and Operation Northwoods and their own Army counterinsurgency manuals that teach officers how to commit false flag attacks to blame on their enemies. In short, the people are learning the truth. And now we see the same build-up to a false flag event taking place that we saw in 1995. At that time, the U.S. had a corporate media desperate to fling mud at anyone concerned by the actions of their government, and it had a government that was desperately unpopular. Today, we see the exact same factors at play. If anything, the situation today is worse than it was in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing, with media consolidation meaning that groups of concerned citizens like the Oath Keepers are being attacked by the controlled minions on both the left and the right. And now it is not just the militia that is being demonized by the establishment. It is veterans and gun owners, third-party supporters and libertarians, anti-war protesters, and human rights campaigners, people who are upset with a government giving trillions to the banks that have engineered our current financial crisis. In short, everyone is now a potential terrorist according to the governmental and media agencies that deign to limit our range of acceptable opinion and control dissent. Even the word terrorist means something more than it did back in 1995, now, after the false flag attack of 2001 allowed the passage of the Patriot Act, after the boogeyman of Al-Qaeda gave the NSA the opportunity to announce that they were collecting everyone's emails and everyone's telephone calls, after the former White House press secretary came out and admitted that the Bush administration had made up terror threats in order to scare the people into supporting the government, now we know what the real definition of terrorism is. It is governments scaring their own populations into line. But there is something else that's different now from what it was in 1995. The people are learning something else about terrorism. They are not terrorists for speaking out against their government. They are not terrorists for wanting the government to stop selling their children into servitude to pay bankers their bonuses. They are not terrorists for pointing out that the FBI and the CIA and Mossad and MI6 are behind every major international terrorist event. The people are not terrorists because they do not want to see more death. They do not want more destruction. The spilling of the blood of their fellow citizens is not in their interests. Death and destruction only ever serve the governmental, financial, and industrial interests who always grow in power and wealth in the wake of every tragedy. Time and again, the people pay with their lives, and the governments and the banks and the war machine only grows and prospers. The people do not want terrorism because it does not benefit them. It only benefits the existing power structure. And this time, if there is another staged event to blame on the government's enemy of the day, the people will know who to blame. For the Corbett Report in Western Japan, I am James Corbett.
Many thanks to James Corbett for that excellent summary of some recent false flags. Now, whilst the exact details are seldom easy to establish, not least because those involved have often great power and money with which to try and cover over their tracks. There are often certain glaring inconsistencies in the accounts. If you see media coverage of these false flags, look especially at what is produced immediately after the event, because that is, of course, when people are most spontaneous, and look for differences in subsequent media coverage. So, for example, the World Trade Center 7 was reported by the commercial media on the day, but very quickly erased from the schedules. This is information. The general pattern is quite clear. Use of fear puts people in a submissive state. They are shocked, as exposed by Naomi Klein. They are then able to be persuaded of the importance of certain larger changes they otherwise wouldn't put up with. As George Lakoff has pointed out, governments assume a role as a parent, and in the strict father mentality, justice is equated to punishment. Punishment for anybody who dissents. It's kind of a schoolyard mentality. They have hit us, so we have to hit them back. Except it's our father was bigger than their father, because people are disempowered, and therein lies the disconnectedness which allows this whole false flag phenomena to take off. Because the same psychopathic agencies, same individuals who carry out these attacks, are also involved in benefiting from them, indirectly or directly. It isn't necessarily the same people who set off the underwear bomber down his fake underwear bomb road who will be profiting from selling body scanners, but there is a parasitic synergy between these few agencies and individual people in the name of whom all this is carried out and whose labour is parasited upon for taxes to spend on this stuff are also predated upon. So the way out of this is for people to engage in a reunion, a global consciousness, an awareness, first of all, of what is actually going on, see the pattern, having a patsy, setting somebody up, you have a training exercise going on at the same time, and then you can switch it live. So, not wanting to get too lost into the details, the bigger picture is a routine, and it happens in many countries. We'll hear several examples from Annie Michon now. She's speaking about her experience in MI5, which is the UK's National Security Force. I mean, this whole fiction, National Security, was invented, I think it was 1948 or thereabouts, as a way to legitimise greater spending and greater secrecy. And whilst, of course, there were terrorist acts before that time, they weren't the industry that they now are. National security rests on the concept of the nation, which is in itself a fiction, as we heard in the episode on human resources. Nation states, historically, have been the great killers. The same organizational structure, which offers people protection, also kills people. Used to be it would offer people in one area, one nation would be protected by killing people in another area, and now that distinction is lost. The same larger principle is people are self-destructing through their own fear. This is something that, as much as we can, we should try to banish from our lives. We should embrace the larger consciousness. It is something that's easier said than done, but it certainly helps to see how destructive people's fear can be. And I can't at the moment think of a clearer example than false flag terror. Okay, perhaps the Cold War. That's a kind of a slow motion false flag terror, because, as we've already heard on the show, a lot of that was a fiction that was fueled by the military-industrial complex. Now it's time for Annie Michon. This is from 2007, so thanks to the London Sound Posse for recording this.
I'm sure you'll be aware that I used to work for MI5. I always feel a bit like someone standing up and saying something shameful, like at AA or when I say that, but I'm a former MI5 officer. And because of my experiences there, along with my then partner, David Shaler, I began to look in some detail at the issues around 9/11, because that seemed to mirror a lot of what we experienced and a lot about what we blew the whistle on and ended up being arrested and exiled and imprisoned for. So I just want to run through some of the MI5 stuff, tell you a little bit about our story, because I think this is relevant, because some of the themes we see now in terms of lying and false flag terrorism and government spin and media control all came out during our case as well. So I'll just run through a few pointers from MI5, from the MI5 years. David Shaler and I were recruited back in the early 1990s. Now, at that time, MI5 was coming out of the shadows to a certain extent. For 80 years of its existence, it hadn't officially existed. I kid you not, it just wasn't there. MPs were not allowed even to ask questions about its activities. But for the first time in 1989, MI5 was put on a legal footing under something called the Security Service Act. And under that act, they were supposed to adhere to the laws of this country, again, for the first time ever. Peter Wright, the author of Spycatcher, that notorious book in the 1980s, wrote that in the 1970s, MI5 had bugged and burgled its way around London. I always have to be careful how I say that, but that's what they got up to. But they were pretty much a law unto themselves. But 89, suddenly they were supposed to obey the law, just as the rest of us have to in this country. And during our recruitment, we were told we would be part of a new breed of intelligence officers. They no longer looked at political activists, the dreaded red under the bed threat. They were there now to protect the public from the terrorist threat. That was their job. So David and I, fairly naively perhaps, thought, well, this sounds like a relatively good thing, you know. We'd be doing something to make a contribution to help save lives, potentially. And we joined up. So as they say in all good novels, imagine our surprise when we were both first posted to the political section. In those days, it was called F2B, and that was the sort of code name. My James Bond number at that point was F2B5. It's amazing how these things never leave your mind. And in that section, we saw a whole plethora of the more ancient things that MI5 had got up to. And we also saw the scale of its paranoia and the scale of its monitoring of left-wing and even right-wing activists in this country. So it's a safe bet, if any of you in this audience were involved with so-called subversive groups in the 1970s and 1980s, and by subversive I would include the Socialist Workers' Party, the Militant Tendency, the Communist Party, but you didn't have to be a member. Even if you were just friends with someone who was in that party, one of those parties, you would have a file as a query sympathiser of. Once you have a file, it exists forever. They never destroy their information. And once you have a file, they can invade your privacy pretty much with impunity. Now, I raise this little part of our story for another reason, because we were in that section in 1992, in the run-up to the general election. And it's probably a little-known fact that all people who stand as potential MPs have their names cross-referenced against MI5's registry. Now, if your name comes up and says, you got a file, that file is pulled out and reviewed by the intelligence officers, of whom Dave and I were two of them. So in the run-up to the 1992 general election, an amazing array of files came to light. And most of those people, of course, have been in the government for the last 10 years. That goes from Tony Blair down. Tony Blair, John Prescott, the late Robin Cook, Jack Straw, Peter Mandelson, Patricia Hewitt, Harriet Harman, a whole range of people have MI5 files. Now, I mention this because I think it's a real problem as far as our democracy goes. We have a situation where these politicians, particularly the ones who become Home Secretary, Foreign Secretary, and Prime Minister, are actually supposed to be holding the spies to account. How can they? Because they are never allowed to see their files. They don't know what's on it, but their imaginations are boggling with all their petty crimes and misdemeanors and mistresses and gay liaisons. They don't know what's held on them. So it's a wonderful lever for MI5 to hold against their so-called political masters. And of course, this is an ongoing problem. And bear this in mind, every time the government votes through yet more resources, more powers, more laws, more staff for MI5 and MI6, a so-called socialist government, a Labour government. Bear that in the back of your mind, because I think this is very key to what has been going on in our country for the last decade. Democracy-wise, we are looking at the tail wagging the dog. So that was a bit of a concern for us. But you always think, well, hey, you know, this is supposed to be in the past. The section's closing down pretty much. We don't need to worry about this too much in future. So we move on to the Irish section for 2 years, and then into the international terrorism section for 2 years. Now, I won't dwell too long on the Irish section for the purposes of tonight, but there we saw a number of IRA attacks go ahead, which could and should have been prevented by MI5 and by the Metropolitan Police Special Branch. They had prior knowledge. Either they screwed up or they allowed things to go ahead. And this is, again, a problem, because that was their primary role in the mid-1990s, to protect us from the IRA bombs on the UK mainland. But what I want to focus on spy-wise tonight, and just in case there are any special branch officers sitting in this audience, I would like to say I've had this all cleared for my book, so I'm not breaking the OSA this time. it makes a change. In terms of what I want to talk about tonight, the two key cases came up in our last 2 years in MI5. That's when we were working for a section called G Branch, which is looking at international terrorism. The first one, well, both of them actually, are blatant examples of what has become known as false flag terrorism, where an atrocity goes ahead and then it's blamed on a group, but in fact somebody else carried it out for political advantage. The first one was the Israeli embassy bombing in London in 1994. I don't know how many of you remember all the headlines about that. In essence, a car bomb was driven up, parked outside the Israeli embassy, and it exploded. There were no fatalities that day, just a few injuries, a few minor injuries, particularly among the embassy staff. The three senior Israeli diplomats were out of the office that day, very convenient, even though requirements stated that one of the three should always be in the building during working hours. And after the attack, there was, of course, a massive investigation, and two Palestinians who were studying in London were arrested, held on remand, and convicted of the attack. Not of actually carrying out the attack, but of conspiring to carry out the attack. And they were both sentenced to 20 years each. Now, David started working in G Branch shortly after these attacks. But because of the system in MI5, where the work of officers is passed around every week amongst the peer group, amongst the same people in that section, so that people can keep abreast of what's going on, he saw a report written by a senior MI5 officer. And for tonight's purposes, I'll call him G91, but I know who he is. And he had been in charge of the MI5 side of investigations. And his assessment, having seen not only all the evidence, but all the intelligence, which is not necessarily permissible in court, was to come to the conclusion that Mossad had carried out the attack. Now, this sounds like the wilder fringes of conspiracy theory, but as I said, this is a senior MI5 officer. He had access to all the information, and he was convinced Mossad had bombed their own embassy. Now, why? Well, first of all, there had been another large attack against a Jewish interest section in Buenos Aires a few months ago. So the Israelis were continually pestering MI5 for increased protection around their embassy in London. Okay, well, they might let off a controlled explosion or something, try and ramp up the threat. Of course, that happened. But I think the primary objective was that the two Palestinians who were convicted of the attack were actually very politically active in London. They were very involved in building up a support network to send aid and help to the people on the Gaza Strip and the Left Bank. By arresting them and some others around who were not convicted, they shattered this burgeoning support network. Everyone just ran for the hills, they scattered. And to this day, that network hasn't really got back on its feet. So, of course, there's a political advantage for the Israelis to have carried out this attack themselves. And it just beggars belief that David blew the whistle on this in November 1997. Gareth Pearce, who was a very famous lawyer involved in freeing the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, was the lawyer for the Israeli embassy too. She also subsequently became the lawyer for David. And she came over to see him in a sort of brush contact in Brussels station at one point to get the evidence off him. They went to appeal. It has been accepted there were documents that were not disclosed during the trial of these two people, and it was a young woman called Sama Alami and a young man at the time called Jawed Botme. Those people, despite an appeal, despite all the case law and evidence being on their side, are still in prison. The judges would not follow basic law to release them, at the very least pending a retrial. So they have been imprisoned since 1995 for a crime they did not commit. If the jury had seen the documents that David was talking about, they would not have convicted these two people. And it looks like they're going to be serving the full 20 years. So this is playing fast and loose with people's lives. They will never be the same again. So that was the first example of what is called false flag terrorism. But the primary example I want to cite tonight is the reason why, the primary reason why we left and why we ended up going on the run and blowing the whistle. And that is something called the Gaddafi plot by the media at the time. But in essence, what we have here, David at that time was the head of the Libyan section in MI5. He was briefed officially by his counterpart in MI6 about MI6 funding a group of Islamic extremist terrorists in Libya to try and assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. Now, when David was first briefed about this, he just thought, you know, this is MI6 pretending to be James Bond. I mean, they always used to come up with crackpot schemes they never carried through. But in this case, it appears they did. They had a walk-in, a volunteer from the Libyan military intelligence, and he approached an MI6 officer in the Tunis embassy. I mean, it's always handy that MI6 work under diplomatic cover because everyone knows where to find them. They just go into the embassy and say, you know, can I speak to the MI6 officer, please? And this guy became nicknamed Tunworth. So Tunworth approached MI6 and said, we have a cunning plan. We want to assassinate Gaddafi and we will take power. And then we promise to hand over the Lockerbie suspects. This was a big aim of MI6 at the time. MI6 sort of dived in headfirst, as far as we can see, with very few checks on the reliability or background of Tunworth, and started sending him large sums of money. There were at least three payments of in the region of $40,000. And that was it, as far as Dave heard. Nothing more for a few months. And then one day, he was sitting at his desk, and this was probably about February 1996, and some other intelligence reports started coming across his desk from separate sources, saying there had indeed been an attempt on Gaddafi's life near the town of Sirte in Libya, which is where they said they were going to carry out this attack. And it was a couple of other reports. So he went back to MI6 and said, is this, you know, what you were talking about? And the MI6 officer turned around to him and said, yeah, we did it. That was our man. Well, patently, they didn't do it, did they? Gaddafi is now the new bestest friend of Tony Blair and George Bush. But what had happened is an explosion occurred under a car in a cavalcade. Basically, there were people lining the streets, cheering their dear leader. All sounds terribly familiar, doesn't it? And an explosion occurred. Obviously, the people in that car died, and then other innocent bystanders were killed in the ensuing security shootout. So I think the total, as far as Dave is aware, was that there were 11 deaths that day, down to the fact MI6 had funded Islamic extremist terrorists who were at that point the threat within the intelligence community to the Western countries to try and assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. Now, I can't think of a more blatant, well, I can think of one or two more blatant, but more blatant example that we personally experienced of false flag terrorism. So this does happen. As I said, this is why we left the services. This is why we went public. And we thought, well, it's a new Labour government. They'll be horrified at uncontrollable spooks, unaccountable spooks running around, trying to kill people. Didn't quite work out that way. Labour was in the grip of their spin masters, of course. Labour was also made up of a lot of government ministers with private information held on them by MI5. So Labour went along with what MI5 and MI6 wanted, as far as I can see. So Dave and I end up on the run. I'm arrested. His brother and his two best friends are arrested. Journalists are arrested. A student supporter who came over to interview him was arrested. This was a wide net, a wide circle of attempted intimidation. And of course, David, notably, was arrested when he tried to submit this precise evidence about the Gaddafi plot to the government. Within 2 hours, we were in France at the time, there was an urgent extradition request from the British to the French saying, "This man is some sort of traitor, spy. He's selling secrets to an enemy power. You've got to arrest him. We want to extradite him." Well, he was arrested. We were in Paris at that time, and he'd gone out to watch his football team on Sky in an English bar, and never came back, effectively. So I didn't see him for a number of months after that particular visit. The British took as long as possible to submit the required evidence to the French. Once they submitted the evidence, they saw that what David had done was manifestly a political act. Blowing the whistle is political. The French Constitution protects people who do that. So eventually he was released. But it didn't stop there. We spent another 2 years in Paris trying to fight for an inquiry into these issues, into these disclosures. And the Labour government, by manipulating the media, by spinning their way out of it, has managed even to this day to avoid an inquiry into false flag terrorism committed by MI6. And, you know, I still can't quite get my head around the idea that they have slithered off the hook so easily. They have a wonderful way of dealing with whistleblowers in this country. They did this with David, and they did it with David Kelly. They did it with Catherine Gunn, the GCHQ whistleblower. They do it time and time again. They will say that someone's a fantasist, someone's too junior to know what they're talking about, someone has a grudge against their ex-employers, or they're a traitor. So next time, and I feel we're probably on the brink of another whistleblower emerging from the intelligence community, just watch those steps fall into place. And again, this is pertinent to 9/11, because the same thing happened in America. So it was a bit of a rollercoaster ride. David came back voluntarily to the UK in August 2000, and he knew he'd be put on trial for a breach of the Official Secrets Act. He knew there was a very high likelihood that he would be imprisoned, but he hoped that under the new Human Rights Act, he would at least acquire or establish a defence under the Official Secrets Act. Of course, that didn't happen. They dragged him through a whole series of pre-trial hearings for over 2 years, just to ensure that when he finally got up in front of the judge and the jury of his peers, he couldn't say anything in his defence. He couldn't freely cross-examine his accusers. If he wanted to ask any question, he had to get the permission of the judge and the prosecutor to do so, and of course they struck them all out. And when it came to the verdict, the judge turned around to the jury and ordered them to convict. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with case law in this country, but there used to be a well-known tradition that said the jury can acquit even if the law finds someone guilty. They can acquit in the interests of justice. The law is an ass, effectively, and you know, I'm fully behind that argument. And lo and behold, the jury did convict him. They had to convict him, although some of them were in tears because they knew what was going on behind the scenes. That was bad enough. Dave only got 6 months. That was okay. But the worst bit was how the media reacted to this. And I'm sure many of you don't trust the mainstream media in this country, and very wise you are too. But I saw this so starkly that next day. Because the judge in his judgment said, "Well, I accept that David Shaler did what he did in the public interest. I accept that there was no financial motivation behind this. And I accept that no lives were put at risk by his disclosures." Fine. I was sitting in the courtroom, about 20 feet away from the journalists. They're all busily writing down this formal legal judgment. Again, imagine my surprise. I open up the newspapers the next day, and all the headlines screamed, "Shaler sells agent lives down the river for money." It's so blatant how the media is controlled and spun in this country. The spies have ways of ensuring that they get a good press. They get the editors, they get the proprietors, have chummy little lunches in the HQ of MI5 and MI6. They sometimes place agents of influence within the newspapers to ensure the right message is always put out. So if you look at the headlines, you look at all these strange headlines around these so-called terror plots in the UK now, screaming headlines, 45 minutes from Armageddon. Remember that one? That's how they do it. I saw it up close and personal. It goes on day in, day out. And that's really why I wanted to just run through some of the MI5 side of things, because we have experienced it. We have seen it from the inside, the false flag terrorism, and we have seen how they react when someone challenges that. We have seen how they can control the media, how they can even control the judiciary to a certain extent. It goes on. It is not some theory, it is fact. So I'd like to go on as well. I mean, David is not unique, obviously, in blowing the whistle. There are many other whistleblowers, and there are many other examples which are now established through judicial inquiry of false flag terrorism. And just to run through a few of them quickly. Everyone remembers the tragic case of Alexander Litvinenko. I mean, what more horror could we face than someone being poisoned by polonium-210 in that death mask agony on the hospital bed? It made such a strong impression on us all. We could all feel for him and empathise. But it was interesting, again, watching the media, how he was always described as a Soviet or Russian dissident. It's like harking back to the good old days of proper spying. We have to bear in mind that what this man did was blow the whistle. And what he blew the whistle on was the bombing of some apartment blocks in Moscow in 1999. Now, this was blamed on Chechen rebels. And this was used as the pretext to formally invade and take power and eradicate the Chechen rebels in Chechnya. But it turns out, the whistleblowing of Alexander Litvinenko, that it was the KGB, or the new form of it, the FSB, who had bombed the apartment blocks themselves to provide the pretext for that war. That was barely mentioned in the media during his death agonies. Another example. You go back a few years, there's a whole plethora of established facts about false flag terrorism. Another one, very famous, very notorious one from the late 90s, is all the stuff that came out about collusion in Northern Ireland, where we had the Barron report looking into the supposed loyalist bombings of pubs in Dublin in the early 70s. That has now been established as collusion with the security forces. We look at the Stevens inquiry into what goes on in Northern Ireland, what went on in Northern Ireland. Again, it's been established there is collusion between the security forces. Sounds so soft and sort of fluffy and protective, doesn't it? Security forces. MI5, MI6, the RUC as was. Running people in to actually encourage loyalist terrorists to bomb people, to kill people, to torture people. And in fact, there was a very notorious whistleblower, an agent codenamed Steak Knife. I don't know if you remember that case. Came out in 1999-2000. And he basically said that as a well-placed source, he was head of the IRA security... one of the loyalist security wings. No, IRA security wing. And he was enforcing security within the organisation. And he had actually ordered and participated in torture and murder sessions, including some other MI5 or RUC agents. This goes on time and time again. It is dirty, it's a hall of mirrors. But also historically, I mean, how many have heard of Operation Gladio? This is quite an amazing one, where you have the notion that after the Second World War, as the Soft Bloc takes power, something called Operation Gladio is instigated, which is only known to the highest echelons of all the governments in Europe. It's a NATO initiative, where you have what are called stay-behind armies in case the Soviets swept across mainland Europe, where you have caches of arms and explosives to be used by those stay-behind armies, all in the best interests of Western democracy, of course. But then you look at how it was used, and this has come out through legal cases, particularly in Italy, where terrorist atrocities were committed, blamed on far-left guerrilla brigades, and then it evolves that it was these NATO Gladio forces that were carrying out the attacks. Similarly with the shooting in Brussels. This has gone on time and time again. And one final thing as well, before I slide gently and gracefully into 9/11. This is something that I think mirrors what may possible theory about 9/11, which is Operation Northwoods, and I'm sure many of you are aware of this. So just briefly, this is a proposal put up by the military to the government in the US in 1962, whereby they proposed that they would instigate a number of false flag terrorist atrocities in order to justify a full-scale invasion of Cuba, bombing campaigns on the mainland in Florida and Washington, the sinking perhaps of a US naval ship in the Guantanamo Bay, lose all the personnel lives, but primarily, most importantly perhaps, the shooting down of a drone, a remote-controlled drone, over Cuba, purportedly full of US students on vacation, actually really initially boarded by CIA operatives who were then substituted by a drone, and then blamed on the Cubans. Perfect pretext for an invasion. This, of course, was vetoed by President Kennedy. So, I'm just trying to run through some of these examples. False flag terrorism is a reality. I've seen it from the inside, and I've researched from the outside. This happens time and time and time and time again. It is a perfectly standard weapon in the arsenal of both governments and spies. So we have to see this as a historical fact. And therefore, every time there is a major terrorist atrocity with massive repercussions around the globe, potentially, we always have to keep that in the back of our minds to question what might really be going on. Now, I'm not denying, of course, real terrorist attacks happen. There is no doubt about that. But always keep that intelligent part questioning what is really going on in the background. So this takes me on to 9/11. This is why both David Shaler and myself began finally to look at the whole issue around 9/11. And I have to say, there is a growing mountain of evidence to suggest that, at the very least, the official version does not add up. I personally would go further and say there is a huge weight of evidence to suggest that rogue elements of the administration in the US were involved in planning and carrying out the attack. And you would say, well, why? Why would they do that to their own citizens? Well, there's a very famous document called PNAC, Project for the New American Century, and this basically says that America requires energy reserves. And I'm sure many of you are aware of this, but for those of you who are not, this was written even before George Bush stole the presidential election, a few months before that. And it was written by a bunch of neocons. And they basically said, we need the energy reserves of the Middle East. Fine. How are we going to do this? We need some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor to justify military adventurism in the Middle East. That doesn't prove they did it, of course. It doesn't prove there was complicity or awareness. But it's always useful when you're looking at a crime to look for the motive. I mean, that's one thing I learned from reading Agatha Christie's when I was very young. That seems to be a very interesting motive, potential motive. But then you look at all the weight of evidence coming out since the attacks. We have eyewitness accounts directly contradicting the official version, which have been ignored, blanked out of the official report. We have a growing weight of scientific evidence showing that what happened that day could not conceivably have happened through understood science. And we have a whole range of whistleblowers coming out from the inside, both the administration and the intelligence agencies in the US, saying that they tried to do something, they were stopped, they were shut up. All these whistleblowers have been massively gagged and injuncted in the US. Why? Just to run through a few headliners, and as I would always say, please don't believe me, look at it for yourself. Don't believe the mainstream media, don't believe what the administration or the government tells us, don't believe me. Go and do your own research because it's so important. And there are a whole range of things to look at. First of all, of course, the Twin Towers. They were struck by aeroplanes high up. The official account says that the heat of the jet fuel fires melted the steel, broke the joists, and all the floors pancaked down. Sounds quite intriguing. You know, I'm not a scientist, perhaps that's true. Then you look at the actual basic science of it. Even I can remember this from my 14-year-old physics. And if you're looking at a tower coming down through the pancake theory, even if there's minimal resistance of each floor, below the point of impact, you are looking at 70-plus floors. So even if each floor takes only half a second, like that, to break and to go down, all those thousands of steel bolts and joists collapsing simultaneously at the same time, you're looking at a 35-minute collapse. Those towers, if you watch the footage again, come down at free fall speed, around 10 seconds each. Now, I don't know what did happen. None of us knows what happened, really. But we can ask the question, how do they come down so fast into their own footprint? There must have been some form of additional energy applied to the buildings to bring them down like that. All I would say is we need a proper, full, open, and accountable inquiry to get to the bottom of what happened. And of course, there's Building 7. I'm sure many of you are fully aware of that case. That was another building in the World Trade Center complex, which was 47 stories high. Now, it looked tiny next to the Twin Towers, but that's almost as tall as Canary Wharf. It was a massive structure which conveniently housed Giuliani's bunker, various Wall Street investigations, CIA, FBI offices, that sort of thing. That came down at 5:20 on September the 11th. And that came down, excuse me, again, with a classic pattern of some sort of controlled demolition. It bowed in the middle initially, fell free fall speed, 6.5 seconds, straight down into its own footprint. How? It wasn't even struck by a plane. The official version was, well, you know, there were ancillary fires, bits of debris hit it, and, you know, we were concerned and that sort of thing. But even the officials don't know precisely how it came down. Then you look at the Pentagon. Again, this is a wonderful story. I mean, in fact, this is what triggered me, but I'm not sure if it's the strongest point now. You have the official version of the hijacker, a young man called Hani Hanjour, flying, taking over this huge great airliner, flying at over 500 miles an hour, 30,000 feet, few navigational aids. He's never flown a big jet before. He's only barely flown Cessnas. He was barely capable of doing that. So he crosses a couple of states, finds the Pentagon, and manages to spiral down over 7,000 feet in a couple of minutes. And he goes all the way around the Pentagon as well, doing this, until he flies in very low, still at about 500 miles an hour, bounces off the lawn in front of the Pentagon, and impacts with the Pentagon. And the impact, before the facade comes down, you can see the photographs, shows a very small round hole of about 16 to 18 feet wide, about the size of the fuselage of the jet. Now, I just find this amazing that this guy could barely fly a Cessna, couldn't get insurance to fly Cessnas at his flying school, and yet managed to achieve this with a large commercial jet. Commercial pilots have looked at this and said it's virtually impossible because of the physics, the stress on the plane. But more intriguingly as well, of course, the Pentagon is the most defended, one of the most defended buildings, probably the most defended building on the whole planet. They have an automatic anti-missile defense system. Anything not sending out friendly fire signal is automatically shot down out of the air. Well, a commercial jetliner does not send out a friendly fire signal. Only US military weapons can do that. So this thing is flying gradually towards the Pentagon, spiraling down, and then goes straight in. And it's not shot down. Why not? And the other thing, of course, is this plane just pretty much vanishes into this tiny hole. Now, commercial jet airliners have a carbon nose, which is where they house the navigational equipment. How could that carbon nose not only penetrate the first wall of the Pentagon, which is a foot and a half thick, reinforced concrete, but go through six to the back of the C-ring? It can't be done. We don't know how it happened. Possibility is it could have been a missile. We don't know. But again, I would urge that we need a formal, proper, open inquiry to get to the bottom of this. And of course, Shanksville, there's been so much controversy over that. Or whatever it was flying towards Washington. Oh, well, of course, there were these brave passengers. They sort of managed to crash the jet. Well, there's an interesting thing. There's supposed to be all these telephone records, telephone conversations. But at the time, scientifically, it was not possible to phone from your mobile from a plane. It's now been established that it is now. It's been announced, I think. There are certain airliners that you can do that from. But also, there have been people coming out of the military. Don't know, you know, how reliable this is, but I'll just throw this into the pot, saying that even though Dick Cheney, the vice president, had control over air defenses that day, he'd taken power of that in June 2001, the military broke their orders and shot down whatever was flying to Washington. So whatever it was, it could have been shot down, we don't know. All I'm saying is, again, there are unanswered questions. We need to have a proper inquiry. So those are the four attacks that day. There are other issues around that, of course. Sounds like they're having a lot of fun out there. There are other issues, of course. Why did the air defences, the planes, not intercept these hijacked airliners? Well, there are all sorts of so-called training exercise going on that day. So the government says, well, all our fighter planes were off in Alaska fighting the Ruskies or something. Weird. One researcher has counted up 22 different air training exercises that day. There's also the intriguing question of the put options. And this is basically someone, somewhere, gambled huge amounts of money on the stock of American Airlines and United Airlines plummeting that day. Someone was very lucky, or someone new in advance, and they made shed loads of cash. But when it came to the inquiry, they basically said, well, that doesn't point to Al-Qaeda, so it's not relevant to our investigations. Now, I'm sorry, you look at a big crime, it's always useful to look at who makes the money. So there's a whole range of different issues. I mean, I could go on about this for hours, but I won't because I'm quite aware of the time. All I would say is please go and look for yourselves. There is such a weight of evidence. And as I said, there's a number of intelligence agency whistleblowers out there questioning these things too. Insiders have come forward directly contradicting the official line. I think Belinda also mentioned as well the testimony of a man called William Rodriguez, who was a janitor in the Twin Towers that day with a master key. So he was in the towers in the basement before the first plane struck. And he and many others experienced a large explosion coming up from below them in the basement. And people were coming up with skin hanging off their arms, with bits missing from their faces, burnt. William Rodriguez is a recognized national American hero. He's even had the dubious honor of meeting George Bush at the White House, and thanks for his activities that day, because he went with the firefighters back in and back into the towers to open doors and rescue people. He personally rescued 15. He helped rescue hundreds more. But despite this profile, they've ignored his evidence. It's not in the Keene inquiry. Despite the fact he now heads up one of the survivors groups, they ignore all those people's testimony as well. Why? What are they trying to cover up? So there is so much out there. All I would say is please go and do the investigation yourself. As I said, my interest was piqued in this because I had seen false flag terrorism from the inside. And all I say is keep an intelligent, open mind whenever there is another atrocity. And particularly something like 9/11, because this has been used as a perfect pretext by the Western governments. 9/11 is not some event that happened many years ago in a country far, far away. This is having repercussions around the world to this day. This has been used to start the unending war on terror without definition. This has been used as a pretext to go and invade Afghanistan, which of course the Americans wanted to do anyway, to guard the proposed gas pipeline across Afghanistan. This has been used particularly as a pretext to invade Iraq. This war has hardly brought stability and democracy to the country. It has resulted in 650,000 innocent men, women, and children being killed and maimed. I mean, this is a crime against humanity, all on the pretext of 9/11, the war on terror. So this is affecting millions of people around the globe, and it is affecting us in this country. We are seeing our traditional freedoms, our traditional rights, being eroded at an alarming pace, again, because of this war on terror. You know, we now have powers in this country which MI5 and MI6 must be wetting themselves with pleasure about. We are sliding towards what is effectively a police state, virtually blindfold. And just to run through some of these powers, I mean, people have been very, very angry at the idea of internment, where people can be imprisoned indefinitely, without evidence, without any sort of trial, on the say-so of a junior or middle-ranking faceless intelligence officer. We are seeing people being picked off the streets of their hometowns and flown off on extraordinary rendition flights. It's a lovely euphemism, that, isn't it? Extraordinary rendition flights, torture flights. This has been proven again, where people are kidnapped and taken to secret torture camps around the world or to Guantanamo Bay, where they have no access to a lawyer, where they can be maltreated. I don't think the Americans call it torture. They can be maltreated and then face some sort of military tribunal. But we're also on top of that seeing the erosion of our traditional freedoms. I mean, the American Constitution is in shreds now. The Patriot Act has seen to that. There are very few constitutional rights actually left. This country, well, we never had a constitution, did we? So who cares? They have introduced so many draconian laws since 9/11. We are looking at new counterterrorism measures. Do you remember the fuss a couple of years ago whereby they said, oh, we want to be able to hold without charge terrorist suspects for 28 days? 90 days, sorry. They actually argued it down to 28 days. Well, I am old enough to remember in the 1980s the argument about even detaining an IRA suspect for 7 days without charge. 90 days. They want to push this through again. That's 3 months in prison. And now they want to be able to continue questioning someone, even if they have been charged. It goes against all our basic case law. But it's not just that. We're looking at things like ID cards will protect us from terrorism. Well, how precisely? Even the Metropolitan Police have argued to the government that it will not help in the war on terror. These cards will contain all our details, which can be accessed by so many agencies. Plus the fact MI5 doesn't exactly have a pristine record in not abusing its powers and not illegally investigating people's bank records and health records and things anyway. So, and also, if you look at the four alleged bombers on 7/7, I say alleged because, of course, there's been no trial, they would all have been entitled to an ID card. So how would that have protected us against the activities of 7/7? But it's worse than that. There are more laws coming through. SOCPA, the Serious Organized Crime and Police Act, that's gone through. It's notorious because it means that we are no longer free to demonstrate outside our Houses of Parliament about an issue we feel strongly about without the written permission of the police. So it's notorious for that point of view. But there are other provisions within it which has received less attention. It goes as far as to say that you can be arrested purely so the police can ascertain your identity. And it goes on. Civil Contingency Act. Who's heard of that one? Couple. This went through a couple of years ago, pushed through by the whips, barely any media coverage. And this means that any minister in the government, at the stroke of his pen, can activate it. And if they activate the Civil Contingency Bill, they can basically stop us moving freely about our own country. They can quarantine us in the, if something like bird flu hits a particular area of the country. They can stop us having meetings like this. They can even seize our homes and demolish them, if they so choose, in the interests of national security, and you get no financial reparation. Have a look at it. Look at it on the internet. It's all there on the parliamentary website. And there's another one that they failed to push through last year, and I always hate saying this one. The Legislative and Regulatory Reform Bill. It's become nicknamed the Abolition of Parliament Bill. Now, they failed it. The Lords chucked it out, I think, last year. But this is even more draconian than the Civil Contingencies Act. This says that any minister, not necessarily the Prime Minister, any minister in government, at the stroke of his pen, can overturn any act of Parliament that has been passed before. It abolishes the idea, the notion of parliamentary democracy, such as it is in this country. As I said, it's not law yet, but it's not off the books. They will try it again. So please, please, go and do your own research. We are, as I said, walking blindfold, probably already have walked blindfold, pretty much, into a police state where they have the power to do what they want. They're just not enforcing it entirely yet. And this is why the 9/11 campaign is growing at an exponential rate as well. We are part of a global movement of concerned citizens. And you can see from tonight, it's every age, background, class, creed, religion, colour, whatever. It is an amazing mishmash of people who are just angry at what has been done in our name in the Middle East and what has been done in our name to our own country and other countries in the Western world. It is too important not to take some sort of action. And I think it's very appropriate that we're actually in the Gandhi Hall tonight, passive resistance that changed the face of his own country. We need to take a stand. We need to draw that line in the sand and say, enough is enough. Because otherwise we're going to wake up in what is no longer a democracy. We will have given those basic rights that have been fought for by our ancestors away, all in the name of this bogus war on terror. So please do something. Support our campaign. Get involved. Even just inform yourself and inform your friends and family in your community. We don't want to let our freedoms slide any further. Thank you very much.
Well, even 3 years ago, I think it was very doubtful what kind of democracy Britain had left, if any, but was certainly a point of concern. We're now going to hear from a country with even less claim to that, Putin's Russia.